Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away. Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me. Need a little help, y'all. Yes, I do. Need a little help. Say it, boy. Need some help, y'all. I'll change the world. What it used to be. Can't do it alone.
Can't do it alone.
Need some help, yeah.
Need some help, yeah.
Come on now. Wake up, everybody.
creed of color. Everybody, we need each other. Wake up, everybody. Well, see, we need, wake up, everybody. We
come
need,
on, wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in there. No more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead. Wake up, all your teachers, start to teach a new way. They're the ones that suffer each and every day. Teach the children,
teach the baby,
teach the babies.
We'd like to welcome you to MPH Radio. Today's date is February 18th, 2023. And let me tell y'all something. We have had a real interesting last 2-3 minutes trying to get back on our board. You know, when you're doing the right thing, it will let you know. So bear with us. We will continue to travel down this road of liberation. As we close out our activities for this particular African Black History Month, telling our stories. And you know, our stories are full up of stories of struggle, stories seeking liberation, stories seeking unification, stories of fighting against all odds. And I think today will be one of those stories where we will fight against all odds. So bear with us. Be patient with us. Hey, we don't control this technology, but we do the best we can to make it as a tool that we can use to help unite and liberate our people and make humanity better for all people. This is what MPH Radio and Missing Page of History as an organization is all about. So again, our theme today, and we'd like to invite you to come and join us. We're dialing in at 818-337-0016 as we close out African or Black History Month, telling our story. We'd like for you to tell your story and put your story in our history book. Because who are the best authors to tell our story other than us? So again, I'm the voice of MPH Radio. What I would like to do right now, I'd like to welcome everybody to MPH Radio. And I want to give you something to think about. Like all our shows, we'd like to give you something to think about. In this case, we'll be consistent to raise the question, what is freedom? Freedom is something that fought over, died over, continued to struggle over, and behooves us to come to a collective understanding of what is freedom, how we can get it, and how we can keep it. I once heard a young man say, freedom is having the ability and the means to control those necessities for life. What do you think about that concept of freedom? That's having the ability and the means to control the necessities for life. That's our definition for today. I want you to think about that. And as you think about that, we want you to get out your pen and your paper. And we now going to try to locate and go to Susie. And she's going to tell her story as relates to the history of African or Black History Month. Right now, Susie, welcome to MPH History and tell your story as relates to Black History Month. Susie, the mic is yours.
I'm sorry, my phone. President Gerald R. Ford officially recognized Black History Month, called upon the public to seize the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black America in every area of endeavor throughout our history. Also, February is the birth month of two figures who loom large in the Black past. Those figures were the U.S. President Abraham Lincoln, which was born on February the 12th, when he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and African-American abolitionist, author, and orator Frederick Douglass, born February the 14th, And the last fact about Black history is, according to a book published by the UNIA, red is the color of the blood which men must shed for their redemption and liberty. Black is the color of the noble and distinguished race to which we belong. And finally, green is the color of the vegetation of our motherland. Those are just a few things to signify what Black History Month is about, which started in 1976. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for your information concerning the history and then some of the aspects of Black History Month, or like we would say, African History Month, which we know every month is African History Month. Well, let's continue down this road of liberation. We're going to pause for a cause as we give you some music with a message. And when we come back, we're going to start telling our story. We'll start off with Brother Mill, and he will share his story with us as relates to this month, Black History Month on MPH Radio. We'll be right back. Because we celebrate the principles, and we act out the principles 365 to 366 days a week. We knew you threw y'all a curveball. We got internalized these principles as ongoing living principles that we must fight for and implement on a daily basis. So welcome back to MPH. At this point in time, as we talk about and internalize these principles, we're going to hear many of these principles as to reflect some of our stories that we're going to hear today. Right now, we would like to bring in Brother Mayor W. Smith, who has a journal, MWS Journal, and he's going to share with us for this particular Black History Month his story. Brother Mayor, welcome to MPH Radio. What is your story that you are telling us today?
Thank you, Brother Lee. I'm interested in talking today about some history that I've been a part of, and particularly some of the attempts at our people to deal with self-determination in spite of some of the official policies that were supposedly crafted to provide assistance for our communities. And talk about how they actually worked, and namely the war on poverty back in the 1960s, and also the responses to the civil disorders as described by the Kerner Commission later on. And I was involved in actions and institutions that were supposedly set up to provide some remedy to the problems that were cited in these cases. First of all, the War on Poverty, which was established back in 1964 under the Lyndon Johnson administration, came out, established an Office of Economic Opportunity, which developed some good programs. Some of those exist today, like Head Start continues today, which was very much needed and continues. Legal services was one, which was very important, but was quite a threat to the establishment after all, and was finally weeded out. Legal services, which provided services to folks who could not provide for adequate legal representation because of costs, legal services provided it for them. Good program. And community organizing. Community organizing was a part of the OEO operations in the local communities. My community of residence at that time was Springfield, Massachusetts, the area in which I still reside. And Springfield had a Springfield Action Commission, which had Head Start, legal services, and community organizing. For a short time, I was the director of the community organizing unit. I had a small staff of organizers, paid full-time, and a few interns and workers from other programs. We engaged in some work that was not the OEO mandated organizing practice. The OEO was set up to provide a good look at attacking poverty. Good look meaning they wanted to make themselves look good, to make the government. I have to recall a professor of mine in college indicated that the oppressor is never willing to pay for his own demise. And in organizing, community organizing, there is always the threat that, particularly under this capitalist system, that the established institutions will not be very well, because many of those institutions are part of the problem as far as poverty is concerned, as far as injustice is concerned. And if citizens are going to organize for power, then they are going to have to be in direct opposition to many of these institutions. So OEO had an organizing plan, which is very simple, to establish block clubs, to take care of citizen complaints about street lights and potholes, et cetera, but not dealing with real issues of power and the things that were more essential to life. And of course, many of the lives concerned, and particularly in urban areas around the country, and Springfield was representative of that, even though it's a small city, at that time about 160,000 people and a metropolitan area of maybe a million and a half. The population of the city is largely Black and Latino, very, very large. In fact, the largest concentrations of Black and Latino people in Western Massachusetts. And therefore, the hub of urban problems, urban concerns, as it were. And so the effect of the process of organizing was certainly directed at that population. And as I took over that community organizing unit, I saw the necessity for dealing with things other than the planned standard approach at organizing. And we engaged largely in organizing tenants for direct action in solving the problems of high rents and poor properties, uncared for residences by slum landlords in public and private housing, and also welfare recipients who were not being treated fairly by the administration. And in that case, we were very instrumental in having the National Welfare Rights Organization, who came into the area, and in assisting them in organizing a very powerful welfare rights movement in the city. Much of that organization included many of our tenant organization members, who were also welfare recipients, and largely mothers who were recipients of ADFC, Aid to the Families of Dependent Children, AFDC. In those primary actions, we created some disturbance in the city, brought pressure to bear. We had landlords complaining. In fact, in one case, the rabbi of a landlord came directly to visit me in my office to complain about why we had cited one of his members for violations. And my response to him was, why not? I mean, he was a slumlord, very blatant slumlord. In fact, he had one of his properties was a building just a couple of doors from where I resided, an apartment I resided in at the time. But we were very active in putting pressure on and having rent strikes and demonstrations at the home residences of landlords with signs for embarrassing them in their communities and the like, and for sending our white staff members out to residences that were for rent in order to be accepted after our black staff had gone to answer the rental addresses, the rental ads, and been rejected. And our white staff would be accepted, and on that basis, we would bring these persons into court. So those kinds of simple tactics and pressures, aggressive and unrelenting for that time, brought a lot of pressure in the community. On one occasion, on a moratorium day, the anti-war movement was having a demonstration at a site, a church directly across the street from a welfare office where our people were demonstrating for a campaign to, and at that time it was one thing or another, I don't remember, I think it might have been for winter coats that women were supposed to be provided for in the welfare policy, but it had been denied just as a matter of crass neglect by the welfare administration. So there's a demonstration of women and supporters outside the welfare office that day, and a large crowd of anti-war people having a quiet a meeting, a commemoration across the street at the church. I went over to request that they join the demonstration because the anti-war principles that they were standing on were very much related to the principles that we were demonstrating for in terms of the economic injustice in this society and how it was being played out in the welfare administration. The leaders of the anti-war movement agreed, and that whole body of people removed themselves from there and came over and joined the welfare demonstration. The police came and began a rude attack on the demonstration, which resulted in some response that was in kind, and the resulting dismay caused a shutdown of the city for 3 days. Springfield had its revolt riot as a result of that. And a number of our people were arrested but were released as a result of the work of our legal services team, which was always ready and eager to help in the work that we were doing in community organizing. That was a blessing, and it was considered a threat to the community. This is all to say that what was going on then and continues to go on is an indication of how the official attempt, even though in some cases well-meaning, and by some people well-meaning in terms of bringing a relief to the injustice in the society, oppression in the society, is the established order is not capable of bringing the sufficient relief because it is built upon the inequities in the system. It depends upon it. And our people are subjected to that intentional systemic injustice. And my work there as a community organizer was directly involved in taking on that and directing our people and teaching our people that the gaining of strength through collective action provided not only some benefits directly to their day-to-day livelihood, but provided that increase in self-confidence and that collective spirit, which would enable them to go forward and challenge the system and bring about ultimately that liberation that we are in need of. In one case, one of the public housing developments in the city, which was considered to be an example of poor public housing in the nation, citizens found themselves without heat during the wintertime because the heating system had broken down. The administration said that they could not fix it because the parts were no longer available, and they would have to wait until spring to find some relief. There had been years of attempts to galvanize the tenants' union in that housing project. But this was the moment and the time in which conditions had arisen to the point where the iron was hot. And a number of things happened, including the invitation of the senator at that time, Edward Brooke, who was a black man who was a Massachusetts senator. He was a Republican, conservative, maybe a liberal conservative, but conservative, liberal Republican. But he came, he responded, came down, and the tenants' organization that had come together around that issue to strike and to provide an escrow account in a local church that cooperated with us, and to consolidate their membership and identify their leadership, and went on strike. He says, we will not pay rent until this heating situation is solved and repaired. Many people had burned their ovens out trying to keep warm by using their ovens for heating in this housing project. And all of this was enough stimulus for people to finally say, all right, we will cooperate together, form this union, give action, and stand up against this administration, which was attempting to get away with just neglecting the people. Well, they did not neglect. That strike lasted only a total of 3 months, and from beginning to end, and only 1 month after the senator came down and got involved. The administration found parts from somewhere, or made parts, and they got the situation solved. So this is something that we did in the as a means of organizing, and not as a means of organizing in the way that the OEO had recommended and mandated that organizing be done. In fact, the OEO did not appreciate this kind of thing. This was off the charts. And eventually my staff was laid off at the local agency, and I was given the offer of a promotion upstairs, more money, another position in another part of the agency. And there was a meeting of the board, and I declined the promotion and resigned with some intrepidation from some of the board members. But they eventually hired someone and brought back staff, some of them, and continued their way. But during that period, it was evident that this agency and the war on poverty, in many ways, despite the well-meaning of some people, and in some places perhaps, was not intent upon developing power among the people to solve their problems and to make significant changes. And that was the war on poverty and OEO. But later on, some years later, in another area in Boston, in Boston, Massachusetts, 100 miles away, I had taken a position as executive director of a group called the Boston Community Media Council. And this organization was comprised of top people from the local media organizations in Boston. That is the Boston Globe newspaper, the Christian Science Monitor newspaper, the WGBH television, which is one of, if not the most prominent production house in public broadcasting, television broadcasting in the United States. Much of the public stuff comes out of there.
Can we stop you for a second, Brother Neil, and ask you that, can you hold on to that story for another program, because we have extended our time. We do have quite a number of people on the board who are going to seek to tell that story, and you have a very interesting story, and I do agree and like the collective aspect of it. And we'd like to thank you for sharing your story today on MPH Radio as relates to Black History Month. We thank you very much, but we would like for you to share with our listening audience, how can they get on your email list as relates to getting copies of your journal that you produce on a monthly basis?
All right. Hey, glad to have joined you, Brother Lee. And folks can reach me at MWS. I'm sorry. That's the wrong one. Mel Manjaro at yahoo.com. That's MELMANJARO at yahoo.com. And that's, I will certainly send, for all who are interested, the MWS Journal, which is offered periodically, not regularly, about once a month, usually. But I'd be glad to send it out.
Thank you, Mel. It's an excellent journal. We would advocate all those who hear this program, please reach out, get on that list, but it has information that people must know and can use as a tool as we fight for our liberation. Again, Brother Mel, thank you for your contribution and telling your story today on MPH Radio. We thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Next, we will continue to tell our story as we bring in Sister Deborah Hall. Sister Deborah Hall is the founder and the president of Mothers Support of Fair and Equal Treatment 2020. We now will bring in Sister Deborah, and she's going to tell her story for this year, Black History Month, for MPH Radio. Sister Deborah, welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. I love this show. It's very interesting, and I learned so much as I was listening to the gentleman before me. You learn so much on this show, and I just want to say thanks to Brother Lee for just being a fighter and staying strong, because you do a little something, but you don't know how it's affecting everyone. So what you're doing, although you may be having some struggles, is really very educational, and I want to say thank you. Our group is Mothers in Support of Fair and Equal Treatment 2020. We are mainly on social media because a lot of our mothers are a little older and they're not into protesting. But we have taken up the banner of writing letters, emails, calling our legislators, anyone we elect and put into office, we believe they should do what they say they're going to do. Now, we're not naive, we know they're not, but what we are trying to do is hold them accountable. So, like I said, we was established in 2020 in June. The organization is an advocacy group committed to social injustice and equal opportunities. The organization is based in Richmond, Virginia, but is networking nationwide with other organizations to advance the call of equality. The main mission is to support causes which enhance the positive development of our communities by promoting economic justice and social welfare. The group is devoted to educating women on how to make their voices heard through lobbying, writing letters to elected officials, and positively influencing their communities for the future of their children. MISFET 2020 hosts forums for dialogue and meaningful exchange to discuss relevant information and to inform their members. We are here today, and it's been a year. Last year we were on the show to let everyone know about our Moment of Silence, which we do on Friday in the month of February. And we do this silence during this month, during Black History Month, in support of mothers who have lost their children to gun violence. We want to honor their memories during Black History Month. And we do it during this month because we want our children to have a history. Because at killing each other at this rate, it's not going to be much history to have. And so we're saying we want us to honor each other, love each other. And for mothers, we hope they can hear our cry. We love you, respect each other. You're so important to us that we can get the young men to know just how valuable they are to us, how much they mean to us. So that was our main focus, is a very compassionate movement. During this month, just since you have started this year, February the 1st. And the date is what, the 18th? I don't have the stats for today, but I have them for yesterday. 24 people have been killed in 17 days in February. And some of these were mass killings. Hurting. So we start February the 1st. And here it is, February the 18th, and we lost 24 people. I did not break this down into how many were African American, and I did not do that because I didn't want to get too emotional. So I want to try to keep it a little more structured for my emotional state. So this is where we are, and this is what we are fighting for. When I came in the other day, and they had the Michigan State thing on TV, and I looked at it, said, that's what I said, And I went into the kitchen and got me something to drink. Then I went back into the TV room. I turned the station and began to look at something else. You know why? Not because it was too painful, because I'm desensitized. Not because I was devastated, because devastation is the norm for America. We live in a devastated state. So no, I wasn't devastated. It's just that I've seen it all. I could write the script. I could have produced the show. I could tell you exactly what happened. A news reporter came in and said, break in. We just had a mass shooting in Michigan. And we're going to this reporter. The reporter came and said, another sad day in America. Someone just came in and killed this many students. We don't know if they're dead. We don't know if they're alive. There was a shooting. And he's guessing and he's speaking and he's saying all these different things because he don't have the information. Then the next thing they do, they go to someone there. And she says, and I thought it was going to kill me. And I could hear the shots. They were coming in. It was like pow, 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 pow. And I could hear them. I didn't know what to do. Then they go to this other person. And he says, I was texting my wife. I just knew I wasn't going to make it out. I just can't believe this happened in our community. This is a good community. I don't know what happened. I can write the script. I don't need to see it. Then they're going to find the mother on late night TV, and then I'm going to look at her, and she's going to be really crying. The mother's sorry because they lost their child, and they're going to show pictures of the child, and everybody will say, oh, how sad it is. Then they're going to have a press conference. The mayor's going to come. The chief of police is going to come, and people who just want to be seen is going to come, and they're going to make an announcement. They're going to cry some tears, whether they will or not, I don't know. But they're going to shed some tears, and they're going to say, oh, this is so sad. We got to do something. And then they're going to go home. And they're going to continue on with their life. And you know why we do that? Because it's too much to deal with. Because we don't know what to do. It has overtaken our ability to cope. We don't know what to do. So as I share with people, I tell them, I say, devastation is the new norm in America. If I hear another reporter say they're devastated, I don't get devastated about what? You weren't devastated, Sandy Hook? How about Colorado? How about the man who went in and killed the black woman who was sitting in church praying, the black parishioners there, and they invited him into Bible study? Oh, you ain't devastated? How about the grocery store in New York where the black people were shopping and the man went in there and killed them? You ain't devastated? How about the gay club daggone in Florida where they killed those people? You ain't devastated? Now you're devastated? We live in a state of devastation. And excuse my passion, but as we try to fight this, what we're up against is this new norm. People have just shut down. Mentally, they're used to hearing it. They don't care anymore. What can you do? The politicians are being paid off. I go out and vote. They get in there. So we are saying, look, we're just like you, my loves. We don't have the answer either. But what I say to you, let's just not take it as the new norm. So every Friday at 3 o'clock, we take a moment of silence. Just a moment. You can pray, meditate, do whatever you desire. But just a moment to remember that these people that were here last year are no longer here because it's living worse than the Wild Wild West. Because in the Wild Wild West, they had a six shooter. So you had a chance to get away. But with the guns and the rifles and the ammunition they're coming out with and walking into places today, the chance is very, very slight. So we're very passionate about this during this month, and some of the things we accomplished in the past, we were very, very vocal, and we sent a lot of petitions to get the no-knock warrant passed, and we got it passed in Richmond. Right now we're looking at the George Floyd, and we don't know how we can play a role in that. I have connected with some other groups who are trying to get that passed, but we don't know what's going to happen there. On the other side, we're also focused on education because mothers, and especially single mothers, who are trying to educate their children up against a complete war. It's a war in the school system now. There's no other way. DeSantis of Florida has declared war. He just outset it. When you tell people we're going to discuss everything else except your history, you have declared war. Recently, a group of young students in, I think it's Tuscaloosa, over 900 protested because the school said they could not have Black history, I think, before 70. And I may have this incorrect, but you can check it out. I think it's before 1970. They couldn't tell any history. And I thought, what is going on in America? How dare you tell me what I can do with my history? How dare you tell our young people what history they're going to have and what history they're not going to have? And how do you feel so good about it and so self-assured and so confident that you can do this as a policy? What is happening? So we mothers are looking into stuff like that. We're trying to support our young children who are out there trying to fight, and they don't know how to fight. And some of us, our younger days have gone, we don't know how to fight, but we know how to complain. We know how to write letters. We know how to talk to senators. We know how to find a way to lobby. So this is what we do. We do it out of compassion of love. We do it out of just pain, because when we see our young people getting killed, pain. So that's what we do. And I'm so thankful that you allow me to come on today and speak. And if you have any questions afterwards, I will be more than glad to answer them. But if you would, at least on Friday, in your world, whatever you're doing, just take a moment of silence. We, the radio station in New Jersey, one of the radio stations there is supporting this cause as well. And we are hoping as we grow that we can get it nationwide. Like I said, just to get people say, hey, this new normal is, we're not going to make it the new normal. This devastation that we're living in daily, not knowing that when we send our children to a football game, not knowing when our children go to church, whether they're really going to come home because of a mass shooter. This devastation, we have got to not let that become our new normal. I want to thank everyone for listening to me. I don't want to hold you up because I'm passionate and I could go on and on. But that's our main cause, and we are Mothers in Support of Fair and Equal Treatment 2020. We are on Facebook. We have a website, but it's being rebuilt, as I shared with the group the last time. I'm not a person in technology. And when we get someone, a lot of times it costs a lot. So we have to kind of wait till someone else come around. So we found this young lady that's very good, and so she's working on our website. But we're on Facebook, and we are private now, and we started private because we didn't want to receive a lot of negative stuff from people out there just playing. But we're hoping to go public. The board met, and we're going to go public in, I think, next March, if I'm correct. And so then everybody, without having to ask and be on, would be able to get on. So, again, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Sister Deborah, is there an email or a phone number that you can give out for people who would like to join your organization and support your organization? And I would like for you to speak just a little bit more briefly on a statement, which was a very powerful statement in terms of when someone decides to not to teach your history, then they have declared war against you. Can you just talk a little bit from that? That's a very powerful statement from your perspective.
In our perspective, we think they're declaring war because if you don't know your history, you don't know who you are. How are you going to tell me to have confidence when I don't know who I am? But when you tell me from whence I come, no matter what's going on in my life, I can stand. I can lift my head up and I say, hey, you know, I come from kings and queens. My ancestors helped build a pyramid. You know, my ancestors survived slavery, terrible slavery, which I don't know of any other group that has survived. We have survived people mentally messing with our minds so that if you light skin, I don't like you. If I'm dark skin, you don't like me. Do you understand the mental fight that is? That's a war. And it creates a war within your community. It creates a war within yourself. So when DeSantis stand up in Florida and tell these young people, and especially the residents, how he wants education and he thinks Black history or history is CRT, or I'm getting critical race theory, and he's got all that confused because he know what it is. He's a well-educated man. He don't want the truth to be told about his people. He don't want the truth to be told about how we overcame and survived through the grace of God the mess they did to us. He don't want that told. So therefore, they present the history they want to present, and people walk around confused. You know, I was listening to the gentleman speak before, and I thought, my God, he's done so much. And I was thinking to myself, we don't even know to thank our forefathers who come before us and who fought the way. I can sit over here and live where I live and eat where I live because people died and fought for me. They didn't give this to me because they liked me. They didn't let me do this because they thought I was so great. People died. People fought. People protested. People lost jobs. People lost a lot so that I can sit here today, say what I have to say. And that's the history they want to erase. That's what they want. They want to make it look like they just was good people. Abraham Lincoln was just a Christian man. These were just great people that wanted to help us. They were not. They were not. They had pressure put on them from all angles, and they did what they did. And I thank God that they did it. But we had to keep fighting. We had to keep fighting. And today, we are here today in 2023. Come on, people. Black History Month, talking about what history you going to teach me in my school. Yes, you have declared war. You have officially declared war on me and my people. Now, how we deal with it is another way. Professionally educated, however sophisticated, however we want to deal with it, because we have a lot of educated black people, intelligent black people. So maybe they can take the fight on in a way. But however we're going to deal with it, we cannot allow them to do that. And for the school in Alabama to tell those children during Black History, how they go, who they can talk about during Black History Month. So what you going to do, pick out Martin Luther King? Because everybody loves him. Oh, but you better not talk about Malcolm X. But he had a movement too, and his was just as important. But Martin Luther King was peace, so you white people could accept him and say, oh, my God, let's talk about Dr. King. You hear his speech? Well, let's talk about Malcolm X. Let's talk about some of his speeches. We have got to stand up because we're at war, and we don't even know we're at war. We don't even know we're at war, and that's the sad part about it. But they are doing things. They think, they strategize, and they hold their emotions in so they can look intelligent, what they deem intelligent on television. And they speak with the way they want to speak, fluently, but they're declaring war on us. And so when I said that, that's what I mean. War has been declared another long time and we didn't know it. This is why we fight within each other. This is why a brother can walk down the street and shoot another brother because you're looking at his girlfriend or you stepped on his tennis shoes because you don't know who you are. You don't shoot people for that. You walk away. But your pride and your ego is so hung up in that because where else can it be hung up at? Where do you want them to have pride? Where do they have pride in? They can't have pride in being black. We don't know our history. We was nothing. We was nothing but slaves. We haven't done anything. So who do I have pride? Where is it coming from? You go to church, you look at a white Jesus. Where is that pride coming from? So, yes, they have declared war. I'm laughing at myself because I get so emotional and I get so out here. And I'm so sorry, Brother Lee, because I know when I get like
sister,
this.
Sister, I'll hear you. They say on the corner, if you smell it, you're going to tell it. You just tell it, sister. You tell me what you're smelling. So we like to thank Sister Deborah Hall, who's the founder and president of Mother's Support of Fair and Equal Treatment 2020. And you heard a call. If you would like to get more involved, please contact and help build their organization, join their organization. They are trying to do something to advance not only our people, but to advance humanity. Again, Sister Deborah, we'd like to thank you for coming forward and sharing your story with us today. We thank you. Next, we'll move on to Brother Maurice Robinson. He's the founder and president organization called SLANG. He would talk about SLANG and other organizations, but he also is a youth and an educator. We'd like to hear his story, so we can bring this brother in, Brother Maurice. We welcome you to Young Page Radio. What is your story as we talk about celebrating the continuation of the so-called African History Month or Black History Month? Brother Maurice, welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Lee, for having me here today on this 18th day of Black History Month. My story is a part of a collective story. I am a member of SLANG, Struggling, Living, and Never Giving Up, which is a political education youth organization to try to educate our youth about our struggles, about our history, about our leaders, and also about our what solutions that we could take upon of getting to true liberation and freedom of our land of Africa. Also, I am a member, a organizer for the Pan-African Revolutionary Socialist Party, PRSP, is the organization that struggles for Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under an all-African scientific socialist government. This history has showed us, our history as a collective of people, this history we lived in the United States of America has showed us that the government has failed us, as Malcolm X has stated, and they failed us because their system is built off our struggles and our oppression of slavery, which gave them the means to build up capitalism, to embrace capitalism, which is an exploitive system that exploits the masses of people around the world, mostly African people, mostly of our resources. Our land was stolen from Africa, which gives power for the capitalists and the imperialists, a global form of capitalism, to flourish with their commercial means of whether it's taking uranium and killing thousands of people in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, their uranium was produced in the Congo and transferred with the in combination with the cobalts and the coltan, which one of our great leaders who schools need to talk more about, who we need to talk more about. We can't expect schools to talk about them. We got to expect our community and our culture and our educators in the school system to talk about them. As an educator, as you alluded to, Brother Lee, I am an educator in the school system, and I work diligently to inform not only African students, but all of our students about the contributions of Africa, Pan-Africanism, and Pan-Africanists. Patrice Lumumba, Kwame Nkrumah, Ahmed Touré, Kwame Touré. We need Malcolm X and also Martin Luther King. We need to learn more about what they don't want us to know. What the wars, as the sister alluded to earlier, the wars on us, on Black history, African history. They don't want Black history because it's leaning towards, it's going towards on a higher level of Pan-Africanism. And that would be to say Pan-Africanism, revolutionary Pan-Africanism is the highest stage of Black history, of Black power, if you will. And that's what they tried, that's what the real fight is about. Because Black history, when you dig Black history, you'll find that Africa is the source of freedom and liberation for Black people. Until we get Africa free, we will not be free. We will continue to have to fight wars, and whether it be America, South America, Brazil, or the Caribbean, and Europe and the UK, we will continue to fight until we free Africa into a united, scientific, socialist, unified country. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Maurice, for telling your story today. And next, we make our transition to Brother Haki. Brother Haki is an organizer for the African Awareness Association, as well as been a writer and an educator. Brother Haki, we'd like to welcome you to MPH Radio. And what is your story that you would like to share with our listening audience today?
first of all, brother, let me just thank you for having me on the program today. You know, my thing, and I'll be rather succinct in terms of, you know, my appraisal of the history. One of the things is, you know, in my particular case, you know, I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to the community itself, the African community itself. One of the things, you know, as a child growing up, you know, in the South, and watching the devastation unfurled, and as related to the lives of, you know, African people, it was sobering to say the least. One of the things, you know, my parents, you know, being hardworking like most Black parents at the time, despite their desire, you know, to see their families prosper by working, you know, 16, 17, 18 hours a day. The bottom line is the kind of oppression that they had to contend with on a daily basis eventually took its toll. One of the things that's very, very ironic is that when you start looking in terms of a ritual that's practiced in African community, particularly with respect to African men, there was this tendency in terms of alcohol consumption, you know, on Friday and Saturday nights. And as a kid growing up, I never really understood, except I sort of theorized in my mind that there was something fundamentally skewed in terms of the treatment that these African men are receiving, which, of course, is magnified through, you know, observing my father. One of the things that was very, very peculiar is that, you know, when I talk about every Friday and Saturday, African men would engage in ritual in terms of drinking. And so, as I came older, it dawned on me that a lot of this ritual was a response to the oppression that African men had to contend with day in and day out. So imagine trying to take care of your family, doing everything you reasonably possible that you actually do in terms of providing for your family. And despite that, you have these forces, specifically white people, who are doing all they can in terms of complicating your life, making life miserable. So when you're working 15, 16, 17, 18 hours a day, when you look in terms of the paycheck, it pairs in comparison to the checks of white folks. So white folks were bringing home thousands of dollars a week when African men were bringing home maybe hundreds of dollars a week, even though African men work harder and longer hours, you know, at the job. So clearly there was something skewed in terms of, you know, the treatment, the very disparate treatment that African men are receiving at the hands of the system compared to white men. So I began to really think about it as a young person and try to make sense, you know, precisely what is transpiring. So as I got older, I began to realize in terms of the social political dimension, in terms of the inequities that impact African men in society, and the subsequent beating down of African men who had to contend with a situation in which, you know, the bottom line is that their manhood was at stake. So even though their attempt in terms of manifesting their manhood, the system did all it could in terms of beating down that manhood, in the sense that make people believe, particularly African men, to believe that the fact that you're less than a man. And so it did have a very devastating impact on the psychic of Black men. And so as a consequence, it speaks to the kind of rituals that were employed by African men, just in terms of not only being able to survive physically, but being able to survive psychologically against a country which in effect says that, you know, you're nobody. And so against this backdrop, you know, African men had to contend with, I mean, tremendous amount of inequality and degradation in their lives. And the mere fact that these African men and women were able to hold their own in terms of being able to do what they can for their families speaks volumes in terms of the kind of tenacity, the kind of stubbornness, the kind of commitment in terms of families, despite overwhelming odds, you know, to denigrate African people in terms of their lives. So we owe a tremendous amount of gratitude to those African men and women, you know, against the odds, who fought, who continue to fight. And they did it, and keep in mind, they did it without having access to lots of education. The bottom line is that during the time I came up, a lot of parents had to stop school simply because they had to work to take care of their families. So this, in terms of the opportunity, in terms of being educated, simply was the option for a lot of people, particularly in the African community. So being privy to that had a profound effect on terms of me in terms of how I see the world. And, you know, when I think about despite the very horrendous conditions that African men had to contend with, when I look at, example, at my father in terms of his strength, And I look at the strength of my mother in terms of being able, you know, to have a large family and still thrive despite, you know, those hardships. Then I begin to realize that's very something very special, something very unique, very something very strengthening about, you know, African people. And as such, you know, I began to understand that, you know, I have some, a responsibility in terms of overcoming this kind of system that adversely impacts the lives of African people across the board. And so, you know, one of the things, you know, when I look at in terms of this African contribution, you know, to the struggle, and when we talk about our people who, without the luxury of education, without the luxury of being informed, without the luxury of any of those things, despite all of this, but able to fight back, to resist the most powerful system in the world in terms of being able to actually achieve against tremendous odds. And so when I look at people like, for instance, Curtis Holt, and I think about Curtis Holt in terms of his strength and his, you know, his tenacity, in terms of being able, one of the first African men to actually, in my life, to actually see standing up against white folks and say, listen, no more oppression. The oppression ends here, and we will resist. For me, that was big. I just never seen an African man stand up and confront white folks and say to their face, listen, we will not continue with this kind of oppression. We will resist. We will fight back, and you can bet on that. And also, when I see people like, you know, Donna Hatcher, you know, the fact that, you know, this man, you know, I mean, single-handedly, I mean, in terms of going, you know, to confront institutions of power to say that the fundamental inequality, the injustice that confronted African people has to end, and that we have an obligation to fight against it. In fact, he, as a shining example, will be the first to fight against the system of injustice, and he wanted the world to know that he's willing to do that, and he's willing to do that single-handedly. He did it absolutely with little support, but the reality is that most of the people in the community were afraid of white folks, and Donna Hatcher was unafraid in terms of taking a stand in terms of tell white folks, listen, you know, the fight is on, and we're going to fight this thing until we die. And he said it in a way in which, you know, he said it without fear. And so to be a young man, to be privy to all these kind of, these examples in terms of selfish African men standing up, taking upon a very powerful system and saying that, listen, you know, that we are somebody and we're willing to fight to attest to the fact that we are somebody, had a tremendous impact on me psychologically. So I owe a lot of gratitude and tremendous thanks to the African men and women of my community as a young man growing up in terms of the kind of examples they've set in terms of fighting against the overwhelming odds. So even now, as we fight the struggle, we understand that we're handicapped to some extent because the amount of fear that exists in the community does exist. The sister alluded to the fact that a lot of times we don't know what to do. And that is very, very true. But a lot of the times, you know, our inability in terms of formatting or plotting a path forward is negated by the fact that we are very, very scared. We understand the power that the system wields, and therefore we understand that the safest course of action is to maintain our place and not to step across the line in terms of alienating the system. And so in that context, it's fear that's motivated us or in terms of our resistance in terms of actually taking a stand. So these brothers and sisters, you know, who actually took a stand against overwhelming odds are, you know, my mentors. These are people in which, you know, I think about all the time, which I have a responsibility to emulate in terms of the struggle against the system. People often ask, well, you know, when you actually take these stands out front like that, then you know inevitably, you know, that you become a target. Of course I know that. I'm no fool. Of course I know that. People like me who engage in these kinds of struggles, of course we understand that when we take these kinds of stands that we have become targets. We are on somebody's computers. We understand that. But we do so because of the example set by people like Donna Hatcher, Curtis Holt, you know, who against tremendous odds took a stand against injustice and suffering. So clearly, you know, we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to the masses, particularly to those Africans, you know, men and women who stood up against overwhelming odds to bring about a better day for all African people. And so in that context, you know, I simply close by saying that, you know, without these brothers and sisters, without their example, you know, there will be no movement in terms of trying to bring some redress in terms of systemic, you know, inequalities that impact African people in the society.
Thank you, Brother Haki, for your contribution and telling your story today as relates to Black History Month. And most definitely the two, three examples that you mentioned in your presentation, they are African people who truly were committed to the liberation of African people, and they must be recorded in our history book. And they are truly worthy to honor and for their name to continue living, to live through the history of teaching younger generations of who they were. They was one of the many, many, many true freedom fighters. We thank you, Brother Haki, for your contribution to today's program, telling your story. What we're going to do right now, we have our board is loaded up with folks who want to call in and tell their contributions. We're going to pause for calls. We're going to take a station break with music with a message. And when we come back, we will continue to bring in new forces, new people, and let you tell your story as relates to MPH Black History Month. This is the voice of MPH Radio. And like always, we subscribe to go forward, ever, backwards, never. And one of the best ways to do this is to tell and know our history. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio.
Enough is enough for the
don't care about you. They came and took you from your home, Africa. They told you then and they tell you now. They don't care about you, but that's not the question. The question is, what are you going to do to protect yourself, to free yourself, and to love yourself? That is the question. As Brother Kwame Ture will often say, African people are not poor. You don't need to piss off at yourself. Ain't nothing poor about being African. Ain't nothing poor about Africa. The other problem is that African people are not poor, but they are poorly organized. We are poorly organized. Solution to our problem lies in organization. Let's get organized. So let's continue down this path, but let's get organized. When we talk about Africa and Black History Month, must talk about going on back in our motherland, our mother, our home, Africa. And on that note right now, I believe we have with us Brother Maurice Kearney for the Free Congo Movement. Brother Maurice, we're going to bring you in right now. We'd like to welcome you to Missing Pages of History, and we'd like for you to take 5 to 7 minutes of telling a story or telling our story from your perspective as it relates to the Free Congo Movement and others. Brother Maurice, welcome to Missing Pages of History.
Thank you, brother. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, you can. We hear you well. Yes, we can.
Oh, super.
The mic
super.
Is yours.
Thank you. Thank you again for inviting us to share with you the ongoing pursuit of a free, liberated, and self-determined Congo and Africa. We're just coming out of the commemoration of the 62nd anniversary of the assassination of our beautiful brother, Patrice Emery Lumumba, who was taken from us by colonial forces, by imperialist forces, January 17, 1961, because he dared to resist the intrigue, the enticement, the offers of the colonials, of the imperialists. He dared to claim what is rightfully his and the people of Congo and Africa, that is the land and the riches therein. And by virtue of that declaration, which he articulated beautifully in his June 30th, 1960 inauguration speech, he was targeted for death, particularly by the United States. The president at that time, Eisenhower, said that he had to be liquidated. However, the man in which Lumumba and his comrades, Maurice Sampolo, Joseph Okito, who were executed by his side, chopped up and bodies dissolved in acid to disappear and remove any trace of them. The manner in which that was done in a way so that we wouldn't be talking about him and his comrades today and the ideas that they stood for, the self-sufficiency, the self-determination, the Pan-Africanism, internationalism. We have an entire generation of young Congolese who are embracing these ideals. And that's where Friends of the Congo, one of the places where Friends of the Congo comes in being by the side of these young Congolese, in our drawing up on Lumumba's last letter to his wife, Pauline, literally from his grave, where in that letter, he said that, speaking to Congolese, he said, "We're not alone. Africa, Asia, free and liberated people from every corner of the world will always be found at the side of the Congolese." And that's where Friends of the Congo stand, recognizing the centrality all part of the African continent. I mean, we call it the Congo. It could be called anything. But the heart of the African continent has been central to the 500-year Mahafa that we've experienced, with 4 out of every 10 Africans that were trafficked from the continent to the Americas coming out of the Congo region and during the period of enslavement. With the heart of the continent being the biggest prize that was given to the colonialists in the 1884-1885 Berlin Conference, as initially as a personal property of King Leopold II, where he ruled it for 23 years, and the population was decimated by half. 10 million, at least, to 15 million perished as the king extracted rubber and ivory. And today, from 1996 to the present, we see the assault continue on Africans in the heart of the African continent, with an estimated 6 million black people perishing as the West pursues the coltan for our cell phones, pursues the cobalt for our electric cars and our rechargeable batteries and all those power devices that generate or that serve as the foundation for the so-called green energy revolution. So we're clear that the heart of the African continent, from the late 1400s right up to this very day, remains central to the viability of Europe, of the Western world. And we are making an appeal to all Africans, to all freedom-loving people, to join us in solidarity, in partnership, in collaboration with our brothers and sisters in the African continent as they face an unparalleled onslaught, not only historically, but right to this very day, as neighboring countries who are agents of imperialism and neocolonialism, as multilateral institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the Paris Club, as foreign countries like the United Kingdom and France and Belgium and the United States and multinational corporations pursue with reckless abandon the riches that are found in the soil of the Congo that were laid there for the benefit of Africans but have been appropriated and plundered by foreign interests, foreign capital. So it is that a message that I'm bringing to you today to hearken to the words of Lumumba and be at the side of the Congolese. Because we believe that as much like Nkrumah did, as he laid out in the challenge of the Congo, that the heart of the continent is central, is vital for the liberation of the continent as a whole. And I'll leave you with what our brother, Martinican brother, shared with us. That the fate of all of us is at stake in the Congo. And by virtue of that, we all need to be engaged and be by the side of the Congolese, because it's not only their concern, but it's our welfare that is at stake as well. So thank you, brother, Brother Lee, for providing me the opportunity to speak to our brothers and sisters on the line and rally them to our cause. People can visit us at friendsofthecongo.org to be a part of this global movement for a free and liberated Congo and free and liberated Africa.
And Brother Maurice, will you give our love and our revolutionary zeal to our brothers and sisters in Congo and let them know they most definitely are not alone. And MPH is over here as a platform to get information out for them and to them whenever there's a need. And we thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, brother. Definitely we'll pass it on.
All right, that was Brother Maurice. That was Brother Maurice Conley. He's an organizer of the Free Congo movement. And most definitely, brothers and sisters, you need to get involved, find out more about their movement, support their organization, and we need to do things more collectively. So the battle in the Congo is the same struggling battle here, and wherever African people are, you must have a free, united, and liberated Africa, and we will get that. And the only way we can get that is for us to work collectively and for us to be organized. Next, we'll bring our brother Bilal Sun Ali when we talk about political prisoners, when we talk about freedom fighters. This brother being on the front line trying to free some of our political fighters, freedom fighters, and one of them in particular is Brother Imam Jamil Al-Amin. He will give us an update with his story as relates to this particular battle and struggle. Brother Bilal, we'd like to welcome you to MPH Radio, Miss Phase of History, and tell your story. The mic is yours.
Well, thank you, Brother Lee. Thank you for giving us the opportunity. First, I'd like to say, seek refuge in the law against misleading and being misled. Seek refuge in the law against betrayal and being betrayed into ignorance by others. And I ask Allah to guide my heart and to guide my tongue and pray that what I have to share with your listening audience will be of benefit to them and benefit to those who are around them. And representing the Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly known as H-Rap Brown, I want to say that we have right now the Fulton County Integrity Unit. Fulton County Integrity Unit is a type of review board. It's the same type of review board that exists in Manhattan. The Manhattan County Integrity Unit is the mechanism that freed those brothers who had been for over 50 years locked up, accused of killing a martyr of Haj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X. The point of the county having a conviction unit is that you don't have to go through to jump through the loopholes and tussles and turns that the appellate division of the state government and the federal government forces you to go through. As some of you may know, when you try to appeal a conviction at the federal level, at the state level, they make you have everything that you want to bring up. They say if you didn't bring it up in the first place, you can't bring it up then. With the county integrity unit, we're able to bring up things that were not allowed to be brought up. So we have over 108 constitutional rights violations against Imam Jamil that are being looked into. We also have the fact that when he was being tried, he chose not to testify, which is his right, and the prosecutor used that against him and actually put on asked him questions and then pretended to be Imam Jamil and answer those questions. The jury, members of the jury, said that that was the thing that caused them to convict Imam Jamil. So that's being looked at again by the county, by the Fulton County Integrity Unit. Also, more importantly, we have a confession that took place hours after the shooting. Some of you may know, and I keep saying that some of you may know, but let me invite you to visit us at www imamjamilactionnetwork.org. That's www.imamjamilactionnetwork.org. And you can visit us and you can see the whole case of what we're talking about. A shootout took place in the West Bend in Atlanta on the night of March 16, 2000. On the morning of March 17, a young man at that time, Otis Jackson, confessed to his parole officer. He wrote an affidavit out to his, he wrote a sworn affidavit to the FBI, and he has since been on Court TV in an unrelated incident in which he was allowed in testifying about these unrelated incidents. The issue came up about the case of Imam Jamil, and he once again repeated that he was responsible for the shooting, and that video can be watched. It's been watched. It's been broadcast over the BBC. It's been broadcast all over the world. We encourage people to go to our website and watch that video. And the Fulton County Integrity Unit, as I was saying, has had an opportunity to meet with and interview this person, Otis Jackson. And we, being that they've interviewed him, we hope that they will soon come up with, they have three choices of things they can do in terms of exacting justice. They can reduce a sentence, which we say he should not even have been arrested, much less tried and convicted. So we're not interested in reducing a sentence. And we would welcome a new trial, because a new trial would allow all the evidence to be brought out once and for all, that people could see the innocence of Imam Jamil. And they also have the right and the duty to free and exonerate a person without a new trial, just kick them out, which they have done on several occasions of people where they have found that they were sitting in jail for murder in instances where there had been attempted murders against them. And so since some people have gotten out, we hope that the Fulton County Integrity Unit will soon see fit to free and exonerate Imam Jamil. And we want him to be free and exonerated, but we also encourage our people to support our political prisoners. And in some cases, you will not find that the political prisoners are innocent of what they have been charged with. But as oppressed people, we have a right. We have a right. We have a human right and a God-given right to do whatever is necessary to free in ourselves. We have a right to take up arms. We have a right to form self-defense units. We have a right to form advanced armed units in order to pursue the liberation of our people. So we're saying to people that you should support our political prisoners and support our political prisoners, whether they are free or innocent, but we should take charge of understanding the facts about the case so that we know when they are innocent, and we definitely want you to support our political prisoners when they are completely innocent of the crimes which they've been which have been attached to them. That's about it. I also want to say that another brother, Kamal Siddiqui, who has been charged and incarcerated because he refused to help the FBI frame Assata Shakur, Kamal Siddiqui. We have formed a joint campaign is Imam Jamil Action Network and Free Kamal Siddiqui Network. And you can read about that if you visit us at our website. And there'll be a program tomorrow in Atlanta at the Little Five Points Community Center at 5 p.m. Expressing solidarity with Kamal Siddiqui. And so we ask you to visit us at the website. If you're in Atlanta, to please come out at 5 p.m. to the Little Five Points Community Center. That's 1083 Austin Avenue. So that you can hear firsthand the issues in the case of Kamal Siddiqui and join his campaign to free him. We're saying in 2023, Kamal Siddiqui and Imam Jamil shall be free.
And Brother Bilal, would you like to say make a few comments about one of the recent political prisoners who just made the transition this past week, Brother Amy Conway?
Yeah, I would thank you for that, our brother Eddie Conway. I was saddened to hear made the transition into the realm of the ancestors just this week. This is a brother who was a leader in developing the Black Panther Party in Baltimore, and the federal government and the state government created a fake party, a false party, who many people innocently followed in believing that they were part of the Black Panther Party. The real Black Panther Party was being led by our brother Eddie Conway, who made his transition this week. Eddie Conway was always in support when we visited him to talk about different measures that was going on nationally and especially internationally to bring light to the cases of our political prisoners. He had always been in support of those matters, and we ask people to continue to support those matters, to support those issues, which you can find, as I said, you can find on the if you visit us at our website. And so long live Eddie Conway. Mm-hmm. Long live Eddie Conway. Long live the spirit of the Black Panther.
And we give our condolences to his family and friends and all the loved ones. And last time, Brother Gain, how can they get in touch with you and become a supporter and an active member of trying to free our brother Iman Jamil Alami?
Yeah, please visit us at that website address that I gave, www.imamjamilactionnetwork.com. And you can call us at 1-800-IJAN, IJAN. I don't have it in front of me. I might be mistaken about that number. But if you go to that website, you'll find the numbers that you can call. If you're in the Southeast, if you're in the Midwest, or if you're in the North or in the West part of the country, there's numbers there that you can call for whatever area you're in to find out the activity that's going on in your area, to be in support of Imam Jamil Alameen and to be in support of Kamal Siddiqui and other political prisoners.
And on that note, Brother Bilal, we'd like to thank you for coming forward and telling your story as relates to Unpaged Black History Month. And let's continue to work together, strive together, be together, and we know we're going to win. We thank you for your contribution to today's program, my brother.
Okay. Yes, thank you for allowing us to be a part of today's program.
Let's continue to travel down the road for liberation as we talk about Black History Month, telling our story. We now going to bring in and Carla. We have quite a few other people still online waiting to tell our story. Carla, we can call out your area code number 612, your last four numbers here 3444. Introduce yourself, and you can tell your story. Carla, 612 area code, last four numbers 3444. Welcome to MPH Radio.
Hi, how are you, Lee?
Sophia, how you doing, my sister? Excellent, excellent.
Good,
how
are
you?
I've been crying in here the whole time. Listening to all these things, I'm just thinking, I forgot about what I was going to talk about because the things I'm hearing, I'm so shocked. And
you going to tell your story. You going to tell your story to
Yeah, I'm going to tell my story, but I'm just like thinking how this country, the things they've done to humanity. I mean, you know, like remember I told you when I came to this country, I didn't even know what black and white was, and the things I've learned, the horrible, horrible things, and of course have happened to me since I was little here. But just thinking about like what color you are, if you're black or white, and you know what I mean. The things I mean, I wasn't taught these things. You know, I think I told you. I come from a family of doctors and scientists, and my grandfather, and we never. You know, I've never paid attention to things like this. And when I hear the people that are talking about the things they're talking about and what they've done in here, you know, I mean, just about like my toxic mold story. So my name is Sophia. I go by Sophia. I have a really long name, and I'm an artist. And at the same time, I have worked with a writer regarding story of my what happened to me in Minnesota here. And thank God for Brother Lee, that I met him, and now he's my agent, helping me to get my work out as far as oppression of humanity and violation of human rights in this country and what they've done to other countries. I mean, that's why I'm over here. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. I mean, what happened to Iran long ago, 1970s or something. I ended up actually in this country because of they wanted our oil so much. And same as what they did to American Indians in here. They wanted their land so much, they threw diseases on them and did this and taking, bringing people from Africa and doing things and still doing things to people. And at the end now, they're spraying chemtrails. And I've told you, you know, Lee, they actually sprayed again today, and I'll text you the picture. I saw it literally, they're spraying and yesterday, and they're doing it all day, and they're spraying fungal spores on everybody. So my story is I am been working at, well, as in not an artist, but I am talented. I used to do art when I was a little girl, and it seems like now I'm trying to see if I can do something with regarding standing up for humanity. I think each of us are born to do something on this earth before we go somewhere, and I hope we go in a good place. I came here when I was 14 years old. Long story short, I came from a family of, you know, and not me, my grandparents raised me when I was 2 days old, and I was kind of raised with money, but not me. I didn't have any money, and, you know, only thing, I was like a talented child when I came to this country. My grandparents had to basically bring me here because of what happened to the United States, and they brought Khomeini there. Long story short, when I was a little girl, I had moved in an apartment. It seems like it's connected now. It is now to what I'm doing now. I was getting sick, and I was 13 years old, 14, and I was having nosebleeds and having trouble studying and having problems with learning. Later on, finding out, years later, I grew up, a lot of things I learned that I did not know what black and white was. I heard bad words about African Americans, and actually people from Africa, well, African background, were the only one actually were nice to me in this country. And it seems like they're like passionate, and, you know, they want to do things and they want to stand up. And I learned that just growing up. Well, 2008, just kind of going to go past this. But my story is because of a management that actually when I was little in this building, I got sick from. And we see, when I was a little girl, I was taught about, you know, microscopes and, you know, putting glass under the microscope and learning about, you know, fungi and things like that. But I didn't remember anything till 2008, 7, I moved in a building. My grandfather used to tell me about certain things and, you know, diseases and things like that. And he was a scientist. And on top of it, he was a dentist. So he knew a lot about fungi and, you know, illnesses, and he used to teach me things like baking soda and, you know, can kill things and little things here and there. I moved in 2009 in an apartment building that, meanwhile, while I was working on my art pieces and artwork, I always wanted to be a designer when I was younger and become an artist. And I'm an extremely sensitive person, and plus I have a learning disability, you know, so I'm not good with big words. I've never finished high school. My family was into political things and standing up for justice. I remember when my grandfather, when I was a little girl, he used to tell me about all these people that have stood up for things and, you know, these old stories that were in our books, in old books in Iran, and heroes, I guess. and when I grew up, I always, like, when I would see something, I would just literally go help something, especially homeless people. I didn't see a lot of homeless people till I came in here. And I remember when if I would see somebody, I would go buy them something or stand talking to them. I still do. And I like to stand up for justice, basically. Anything, I think it's just like it's being pushed down. I want to, like, literally lift them up and do things for them. And, you know, we all want to do something in the world. And so 2008, I moved in an apartment building. And I had moved in, like, literally a mansion in this building. Never have literally lived in an apartment because I used to do elderly care because I wanted to work on my art. I wanted to be a designer. That was my thing. And most of my work actually always been black and white, but I really like did not do so much, but I would do some design. So 2007, I moved in an apartment building and I've noticed I started like feeling very weird. Excuse my language, I guess. I don't know. I guess now they call it anxious. And I kept thinking something was wrong. My dog was blinking. I had a beautiful American Eskimo, and she was like my child, and I loved her to death. And I love animals a lot, and I love children. And I like flowers. And when I was in Iran, I was raised with where I lived in a house. It was kind of villa style. We had like a swimming pool, but we had so many flowers and plants, and I grew up with birds and plants and flowers. It's just I felt very comfortable. I would go sit in like the middle of the, you know, on the grass, middle of the flowers. I felt very much at home because I felt it was safe and clean and decent, I guess. So when I moved in here, I moved in a lot of things. Basically, my grandparents, my grandmother had given me a lot of jewelry from Iran, and a couple were uncut diamonds from Iran and pearls, and a lot of, I'm not the one made the money. She did. They had the money. But my grandfather, actually, I was supposed to go to Paris when I was little. Before I came in here, the goal was for me to go to Paris, go to a boarding school, so I would be able to basically go to college. At that time, they did not know that I was going to get sick in here and start having problems with school. And that's why I wasn't able to finish school. So 2008, when I went in there, I was basically getting sick. I didn't know what was wrong. And I met a woman. Previously, I had met a woman. She was talking about mold constantly. And at that time, I thought mold was on, you know, just on bread. I did not know it was what my grandfather was teaching me when I was a little girl. And the fungus and what it really does is the only cause of actually diseases and all these pathogens and what it gives off. And, you know, pharmaceutical companies come and separate it. They put different names in there, and then they make money off of you. Well, and it's very simple that you can actually get cured with certain things very easily. And then oh, my God, I'm getting sick. I know what was wrong. And anyway, time went on. This woman that I have met her, she was telling me all these things. I noticed she was acting a little bit. I thought she was kind of crazy because she kept saying, oh, my God, I can't be here. She would start jumping around. And I realized, you know, I started doing some searching on the computer, and I thought, oh, my God, this is what I'm getting sick from. I'm feeling weird. And I noticed, like, I was slowly, my weight was I was noticing my clothes were getting a little bit tighter and a little bit tighter, very slowly. And she told me, she said, your building has mold, you got to get out. And I just did not want to get evicted because I have moved in literally pianos, mahogany pieces, 15 Persian carpets, everything I moved in. and I didn't know what was going on. So I thought I better go start taking some pictures. He explained to me what it was, and then I started going to the library in there. I started taking pictures. Then meanwhile, me being sick, my dog was getting, she was blinking, and then I'm starting to have more problems. And then my dog was not, she would not come in the building, and I thought that was strange. She just would sit in the car, would not want to get out. You know, dogs, no animals, no. And I started, like, going to the library. Then all of a sudden I started meeting people in the building. They were telling me they were having all these symptoms. And then I met a woman one time. The skin on her hand was coming out. Literally, I saw his skin on her hand was coming out. And then her skin on her feet was coming out. And I've never seen anything like that before. And I said, well, how long have you been in here? She was trying to explain to me. And I started noticing weird things where other people were telling me things because of the research that I was doing, that I would talk to the people in the building, some people, not a lot. And then I started writing a letter to the management about what happens and why I'm getting sick, and all these things were happening. And they start telling me, like, there was no mold. They were starting to act very strange. Long story short, they did everything to get me out of that building, literally everything. They had police illegally scare me. Not all the police, because I had some police officers. They said, you know, you got to get in that building. You got to let people know. But I would call it, excuse my language, dirty cop, was trying to scare me. And I found out the Department of Health, every time I would go there, I said, I'm getting sick. There's something in here. And I noticed you just would not get up. Well, obviously they're racist in there, I found out later on, but that he would not get up. And this guy is from the Department of Health. I had a police officer one time. She says, Sophia, get a tape recorder and take it in the apartment building and get the guy from the Department of Health, come over there and just tape him on the tape recorder. She told me it was legal. And she told me to put it in my purse. Make a story short, I basically taped him lying. And like I said, they did everything to get me out of the building. They wanted to evict me, and I didn't even know what that word, like, evict was, because that was the first time I myself wanted to rent an apartment building. So I went to court, and they illegally, literally averted me not to go to court. They did a lot of illegal things, actually, and they wanted me to get out, and they pulled me away from court. They said that we want you to evict. We want you to resend your lease renewal offer, and we want you to leave now. And I noticed while I was out there, the property management was in the court at that time. And they basically, like I said, averted me not to go to court and signed the paper. And I was basically evicted. And by the time I went to get, came back to my apartment, because I was trying to find somebody to help me, they had locked me out with no underwear in the street. So I had a Donna Karen self-dress, $80 pair of shoes, and I was locked out with no underwear. They locked me out. And I went everywhere. Nobody would help me, including my own uncle, that I actually wanted him to help me with what they did to me. And he actually made fun of me because I'm Christian, and I became Christian a long, long time ago. And he actually said, did your Jesus help you? I couldn't believe him. My own uncle didn't do nothing. But what's interesting is at that time I was actually dating somebody. So he helped me to, you know, stay with his parents at that time. But like I said, you know, I've been, you know, since then, they haven't really, like, they don't know what I'm actually trying to do. I've been trying to draw some paintings. Well, their designs basically. I'm throwing what I think about what's been done to me, and I wanted to start basically seeing if I can stand up for children, because it's so dangerous, these things that can actually kill people, and there's a cause of diseases. I found out, oh my God, it's a cause of cancer. Actually, it is the only cause of cancer and nothing else. Then I found so many articles. There's one in here. It says indoor fungal infestation. I am mycotoxicity. Now, isn't interesting? I found a scientist. and he was a medical pathologist. His name was Dr. William Croft. When he tested me, this is interesting, I had two doctors here lied about my test, and I knew that I'd been exposed, because when I was young, I had the same doctor that I went to. They said you have allergies to dust, mite, and mold. When I told them in here that I'm getting sick in this apartment building, they lied. His name was Dr. William Croft. I found that he's dead because he kept saying, Sophia, you got to write a book. You got to have somebody help you write a book. So what I did is I found a writer. I had to get on Social Security, too, because of, like I said, I've had too many racist things happen to me in this country that attorneys don't want to stand up if you're not. I always say you're not the right color in this country. They didn't do nothing, basically, to help me. Not attorneys didn't do anything to get my property back. But this indoor fungal infestation and mycotoxicity, see, the doctor that I went to see, Dr. William Croft, that actually wrote a book, and I have his book in here, he said to me, he says, I need to get you tested. So I was tested and I was diagnosed with a third stage. Third stage can kill you, okay? I realized toxic mold is the cause of, listen to this, Lee, it is the only cause of people killing people. It's a cause of abuse. It's a cause of animal abuse. It's a cause of people getting frustrated. It's the only cause of aging because of it. And listen to this. They've known about it for the past 30 presidents. A guy named Arnold Mann, okay, New York Times wanted him to do he was a medical investigator. I spoke to him long ago. And he said, Sophia, New York Times had me do an investigation. I wrote the book, They're Poisoning Us, get it. So I got the book. I haven't finished reading it because I have an ADD and I just jump from one thing to another. It's in my head. So I told him, I said, this is seriously? He says, yeah. He says, I did the investigation. But coming from my background, everything just went back from my grandfather. What he taught me, fungi and kills you, is a cause of diseases, the only cause of dehydration. Then I realized, oh, my God, what they're spraying in the air, it's the same thing as what we're breathing indoor air, but still more stronger. But they're spraying it in a way so that all the birds just don't die because people are going to get suspicious. Then I realized the trees are dehydrating. Then I thought, oh, my God. What they're spraying in the air is same as what I was exposed to. I went from a beautiful woman to literally aging 30 years. And I go, oh, my God, they've done this to African Americans. Even with vaccine. Lee, do you remember? They said they wanted to experiment on the African Americans first. Remember that? I don't remember. But they said, they were going to inject it to the African American first. I don't know if you remember or not, if you heard it. And then people have died. Then I thought, oh, my God, I wonder if they're spraying. No, they're spraying. They have fungal spores in each of these, the vaccinations. Because every person that I've talked to, they said they have side effects of certain, you know, certain things that has happened to their body. But see, everybody's immune system is different. So if you look in here, it's now my art that I'm working on. I wanted to open up a nonprofit organization to see if there was a way I can stand up regarding child health issues, animal issues, you know, and environmental issues, environmental impact on the earth, because it's a serious issue. Child abuse, it comes from that. Child trafficking, animal abuse. And all these things are all related. So in here it says mold spores are, omnipresent and constantly elevated humidity is given in building containing organic components. And then it says it will lead to fungal growth and damage to the material. So they've known it for the past 30 presidents. So since in recent years, indoor fungal growth and airborne particles have gained a reputation of, listen to this, a serious health threat, okay? The extent to which the perception of is justified and controversial. That's not true. This is the truth. On the bottom in here, it says, less clear is the extent to which the presence of fungal material represents an imminent threat to human health. So it says less clear. That's not true. It is clear. It is the only cause of everything, what they're doing right now. They've been wanting to for years. That's what I call it, population elimination. They want African Americans to kill each other and people to kill blacks or foreigners. They're bringing all these foreigners in here, Lee. Have you noticed this? They bring up Somalians in here. Guess what? Their children are getting autism. Why? They're getting sick. I see it right by me all the time. They're putting people, same as what they did to Africans, you know, everywhere. I always tell people, I said, do you think they care about Africa or people in my country? They don't care. I'm looking for years and years and years. People in Africa are starving. God created the whole earth. There's trees everywhere, food everywhere. You know, how can you tell me when a child is crawling on the floor, starving in Africa, there's no food? And why is it all of a sudden the white Christians all of a sudden come in Africa and all of a sudden they pump over there and there's water coming? Come on. This is from thousands of years ago when God created the earth. There's water all, you know, the scientists know that top of the mountains, it's all, petrified clams. There's water all the way up there. So we have water. They want to deprive people. They want to make people sick. And people need to stand up, you know, because they want to kill people. And right now, all these people from Afghanistan are coming. They're getting sick too. I've talked to them. They're blowing up. They're getting sick. They're telling me, I just talked to an Iranian woman last week, four or five days ago. She said to me, she says, it's amazing you tell me that because since I've been in here, I'm constantly getting sick. She says, I don't have no energy. And I said to her, I said, you look at your neck, you're aging. I said, you started to age. You know, why? Because they want to kill people off. They known about it for the past 30 years. Think about it. And that was when I talked to Arnold Mann. That was 2009. So I think it might be more. I mean, I'm sorry, 30-something, 31 or 32 presidents. Sorry, it's my English. But I'm just saying it's not right. So I thought if there was a way I can take my art and throw my you know, what I feel inside my art, and I feel like everybody's got some kind of light coming out of them if we stand up for things. And I called it oppression, depression, distraction. What I'm saying is it's the oppression of humanity, depression of humanity, and distraction, because what these people, you know, the ones that elitists, you know, they call themselves, they're trying to make people distracted so bad things happen to people. They're throwing alcohol to people, drugs to people, you know, guns to people. You know, the white man has done this. And I shouldn't even say this to be racist, but from what I've seen, that's why I think my art is like, it's black and white. Why? Because no matter what color you are, you still have a light that can come out, you know. So I thought, maybe with this organization that we opened up, you know, maybe what I can do is I want to, remember I told you, Lee, I want to see if I can stand up for, like in Africa right now, they're taking children for trafficking, a lot of children, you know, and I thought if there was a way we can raise money, I'm looking at it in here, it says here, 100 CNN, it says 157 children rescued from West Africa, they're all sitting on the ground. Another one, human trafficking in suburban Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa. It says five child trafficking in Kenya. I mean, they're taking all these children and using them as slaves. What did the white man do? Use them as slaves. You know? So somebody's got to do something about it. You know, this country is literally killing everybody all over the world. That's why the earth is sick. That's why we don't have snow. That's why the poor little birds. I go every day and I see birds, like, you know, different places, because they don't have no food. As soon as I call them, they come up. You know why? Because they're hungry. They're making everybody hungry and starving them, and they want to kill everybody else. That's what they want to do. That's their agenda. But nobody wants to talk about it. You know, that's the problem. And these governments in here, they don't care, because I went to everybody. They didn't do nothing. And they kept looking at me up and down. And I was dressed really nice at that time. And I looked at him, I looked at the guy, I said, you're racist. He actually turned around because I blew up, you know, I wasn't thin. The police officer tells me, he actually told me, excuse me for talking like this. He said, yeah, there was this black, big fat black chick. This is how he talked. And he says, yeah, she gave out air. And I looked at him. I said, what are you talking about? You know what I was talking about? I was showing him one of my art pieces that was a Monet, but it wasn't real Monet, obviously. It was a print of Monet and had a gilded, you know, frame around it. And I said, this is, I'm telling you the truth, this is what they did because I have the picture. And that's what he said. He said, some black. And I was thinking, like, then I looked at him. I said, you know what? You officers are all racist, aren't you? And he said, you can't talk to me like this. I said, damn right I can talk to you. I said, I'm from Iran. I said, do you think you can stop me with what I'm trying to do, stand up for children? He said to me, he says, you can't do nothing. And I said, you want to see? I said, I'm Iranian. You know, I said, I'll use my story to do something what I have to do. You know?
And on that note.
And then I hung up on
that note,
huh?
On that note, Sister Fear, we're going to have to stop you. And I'd like to thank you for sharing your story with MPH Radio. And we would like to continue down the line as people are still waiting patiently to share their story. It is at this point in time, you know, one of the things we want to do with MPH Radio is to fill in our missing pages of history. And today, the people are telling their story. So, Sister Superior, we'd like to thank you for your contribution to today's program.
Thank you.
We'll now move forward to our next presenter. Caller, your area code number is 202, and your last four numbers are 7236. 7236. Welcome to MPH Radio. You can now tell your story. 7236, area code 202. The mic is yours. Area code 202. Last four numbers, 7236. You can tell your story. If not, let's move forward. We can go to area code 703. Last four numbers, 9348. 703-9348. The mic is yours. Welcome to MPH Radio. You can now tell your story.
We can go to area code 703. Last
four numbers,
9348.
7038. Okay. Call him
9348.
Yes, go ahead. We give you a call.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, call 9348. Tell your story.
This is Mary.
Hey, Sister Mary, how you doing?
Okay. And I have a poem to read.
Okay. You want to share your poem? You can go and do so right now. This is your time.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we
good.
Can.
Good. Doing good. Thank you. I want to thank you, first of all, Mr. Lee, for having me on the show today. It's been an excellent show, and I just want to thank God for all the prayers that have been sent out. I'm doing well. Thank you. The poem that I would like to read is by Langston Hughes, Let America Be America Again. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great strong land of love where never kings convince themselves nor tyrants scheme that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air that we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I see and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways, of satisfying need, of work the men, or take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, the bondsman to the soil. I am the worker soul to the machine. I am the Negro servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean, hungry yet today, despite the dream. Beaten yet today, oh pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead. The poorest worker bartered through the years. Yes, I'm the one who dreameth our basic dream. In the old world, while still the serf of kings, who doubteth a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone and every furrow turned that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those earthly seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left Dark Island shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lea, and torn from Black America's strand I came to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today. The millions shot down when we strike. The millions who have nothing for our pay. For all the dreams we've dreamed and all the songs we've sung and all the hopes we've held and all the flags we've hung. The millions have nothing for our pay except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again, America. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangsters' death, the rape and rot of graft and theft and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain, and all the stretch of those great green states, and make America again. Let America be America again, by Langston Hughes.
Thank you for such a beautiful...
Again, for having me today. And I pray to God that someone has been blessed.
Thank you, Sister Maya,
for your platform.
And we thank you for sharing such a beautiful poem. And at this point in time, we're going to take a station break with music with a message. And this message we want to send out to all of the mothers as well as fathers to understand that sometimes children do crazy things, but we do know that you love us. And we'll make a tribute to our mothers and fathers right now. And when we come back, we'll be doing our closing out thoughts with Brother Alex, our announcements for MPH Radio, and how we can move forward from this point on. This is MPH Radio. We'll be right back.
When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me, but I was acquitted a month and 3 days before Tupac was born. I was real happy because I had a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the street. So back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, scared to go home. I was the fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Said tears with my baby sister. Over the years we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different days, the same drama when things were wrong, we blamed mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hugging on my mama from a jail cell. And who's thinking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama catch me, put a whoop into my backside. And even as a queen, mama, you always was the black queen, mama. I finally understand, for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did, there's no way I can pay you back. But the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear mama, you all appreciate it. There ain't nobody tell us it was fair. No love for my daddy cause the coward wasn't there. He passed away and I didn't cry, cause my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong and I'm heartless, but all along I was looking for a father, he was gone. I hung around with the thugs, and even though they showed a young brother love, I moved out and started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I sang it. I ain't guilty, cause even though I said it feels good putting money in your mailbox, I love paying rent when the rent's due. I hope you got the diamond necklace that I sent to you, cause when I was low, you was there for me. You never left me alone because you cared for me. And I can see you coming home after work late. You're in the kitchen trying to fix us a hot plate. You're just working with the scraps you was given. And mama made miracles every Thanksgiving. But now the road got rough, you're alone. You're trying to raise two bad kids on your own. And there's no way I can pay you back. But my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. And dear mama, you all appreciate it. Pour out some liquor and I reminisce, cause through the drama I can always depend on my mama. And when it seems that I'm hopeless, you say the words that can get me back in focus. When I was sick as a little kid, to keep me happy there's no limit to the things you did. And all my childhood memories, I'm full of all the sweet things you did for me. And even though I act crazy, I gotta thank the Lord that you made me. There are no words that can express how I feel. You never kept a secret, always stayed real. And I appreciate how you raised me, and all the extra love that you gave me. I wish I could take the pain away. If you can make it through the night, there's a brighter day. Everything will be alright if you hold on. It's a struggle every day, gotta roll on. And there's no way I can pay you back, but my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear mama, you all appreciate it.
mother can pay you back, but the plan is to show you, mother and father, that we understand. We'd like to give a shout out to all the mothers and fathers who can continue to stand by their children, stand by their people, to fight for a free, liberated, united Africa, African people, and a better humanity for all people, because ultimately all about freeing all the humanity. So we'd like to just let you know the plan is to show you that we will understand what you was trying to do when you were sharing our love and our care for us. So welcome back to the Unpaged Radio. And closing out, what we're going to do right now, we're going to make a couple of announcements. Again, we close out with Brother Alex Joyner, a message to the community. Today's program theme was Black History Month, telling our story. You have heard many stories, but all of them sums up or come under one particular umbrella. It's a story of speaking truth to the powerful and the powerless. It's a story of African people telling their history, their story. So what we want to do is right now just make a few announcements. We'd like to remind everyone that our next program, this is by weekly radio program under the banner of Missing Pages of History, Inc., will be February the 4th at 1 p.m. Also coming up in April, we'll be doing a live TV show coming up in the month of April 2023. Stand by for the official dates. And, you know, we'll be coming on the Richmond Metropolitan Area, State of Virginia. Check us out. As well as, if you'd like to join and become a supporter of MPH Radio, you can do that by emailing us at mphradio@yahoo.com, mphradio@yahoo.com. We do need your support, and we can tell you how you can support us. And more importantly, we want you to help join us and join Missing Pages of History so we can build this institution where we use communication as a means to unite our underserved communities. So on that note, at this point in time, we can go to Alex Joyner. You can give his final thoughts about the program and his message to the community. Brother Alex, we now will bring you in. The mic is now yours. Brother Alex, welcome to MPH Radio.
Well, thank you again, Brother Lee, and all our invited guests who came on today. And believe me, Miss Holmes, I believe you got my back in any fight I ever got into. You were superb. I thank my sister Mary for the beautiful poem, and I thank all the other speakers that gave the basically same story, that we are in the fight of our lives for freedom, for acknowledgement, to know that the people of color in this whole world will continue to strive on to make sure that their culture is not erased from history. And that history goes back in our DNA of what, almost a half a million years ago, from the first man and woman. And then, more notably, about 6,000 years ago, for the building of the pyramids and the great kings and queens and pharaohs of Egypt. And then if we roll forward and into the learned history, as we call it, of the Greeks and Romans, you will find the great things that the African culture has done. And as we move from 1 AD to January of this past year, we will look at still more Black history taking shape. And in that shape was Charles G. Woodson many years ago, as he invented or first suggested there should be a Negro Week or History Month. And it was widely accepted in the African-American community, and we began to move forward and celebrate of a Black History Month, which main aim was to make sure that our culture did not disappear. Our history, our inventions, our teachings, our discipline that we gave our sons and daughters to understand who they were so they would not kill each other as they do today, would survive. But what really influenced my life way back in 1967, so 15-year-old girl, Maria Hill, And she was charged with murder of a white man in North Carolina. And my cousin, Reverend Leon White, was one of those men that got out there and walked and marched and preached and spoke about killing a 15-year-old girl. So by the time of the trial, she was 17 and she was sentenced in 1968. It is just amazing how an all-white male jury convicted her and wanted to send her to death. She was found out not to even be there at the scene of the crime. And there are so many other things that had happened that was coerced until I just couldn't believe it. But then I saw a pattern there with the Wilmington 10 and so many other things. And I had to come forward and begin to say, hey, America has a huge problem with its African-American community. And one of those problems is like I would like to share to you today. Friend and pastor James Vincent Carey, for opening his church, Mount Peace Baptist Church of Raleigh, North Carolina, for the press conference where the facts were stated about the unjustified citizen murder of 32-year-old Daryl Tyree Williams on January 17, 2023, while in police custody. As I sat there and listened to the community activists, the lawyers, reporters, and the mother again, this situation of unaccountability by police remains the same. Mr. Williams was sitting in a dark tinted vehicle when the police unit was doing a so-called proactive patrol of the area because it was near a sweepstakes enterprise and other businesses. As the officers went from car to car looking for reasons of probable cause, they approached Mr. Williams' vehicle. Williams was in the driver's seat and his passenger was beside him when his door was opened. They both were asked to get out of the vehicle by the officers, but they wanted to know why. They were never given a reason to get out of the vehicles, and their questions were ignored by the officers. What's going on? Mr. Williams asked several times as the officers forced them to get the car and did a full body search as shown on the video. Finally, the officers told Williams why he was being searched as he detected a white powdery substance folded into a bill. Williams again questioned why he was being detained and arrested for such a small substance. Three officers on the scene then attempted to handcuff Williams as he is being pulled to the ground. Williams somehow got away from the three officers as one calls for more backup on a simple arrest. One of the officers deploys his taser and strikes Williams. As they continue to chase Williams, they curse at him and finally brought him to the ground and appeared to put their full body weight upon him to prevent him from getting up. Mr. Williams is repeatedly heard telling the officers he had heart problems. Even though they heard Williams say his heart was bad, they showed no compassion or regard for his life. The two officers proceeded to deploy two separate tasers to his side and back about 50 seconds apart. Williams again is heard saying he has heart problems as he is begging the officers to stop tasing him. Another officer began counting down from three and deployed his taser into Mr. Williams' neck area. Moments later, Mr. Williams became unresponsive as they checked for him breathing and a pulse. As his body lay on the ground for almost an hour, a feeble attempt of CPR was performed by the Raleigh police officers, and no response was recorded when the Raleigh Fire Department took over life-saving measures till an EMS unit arrived and transported Mr. Williams' handcuffed body to Wake Medical, where he was pronounced dead at 3:01 a.m. There was a total of six officers involved, and Mr. Williams was tased four times with some missed attempts. The police did not care for the safety or health of Mr. Williams. They were going to teach him a lesson he would never forget. They were the ones who held his life or death in this situation. His death meant nothing to them, or they would have listened and noticed that all the tasing was causing him problems. What type of police training say you have to kill an unarmed suspect when you have him on the ground in handcuffs? How can good police officers not want to hold these six officers accountable and stand behind them? Sonya Williams, the mother of Daryl Williams, said his best. They didn't have to kill my son. That was my firstborn. That was my only son. He shouldn't be dead. And I want justice. Justice for Tyree. Justice for Daryl Tyree Williams. Justice for Daryl Tyree Williams. The people in the church and along the march route shouted. So many black mothers have had to say that over the course of my life that I get sick to the bottom of my stomach every time I learn of a careless and reckless attitude of law enforcement as they attempt to arrest their children. Even with all the sensitivity training of police, black people continue to die disproportionately to other races who commit even worse violations and crimes. Our neighborhoods have become a feeding ground for vengeful policing. I look forward to the day that I do not to see this infection of hate or unarmed black men by the bad apples of the police force in America. For now, I have to thank the outstanding lawyers who fight the good fight for the mothers who mourn day and night for children who won't be coming back home to them. National civil rights attorney Ben Crump was compelled to come to Raleigh and call for swift justice to be taken. The filing of the criminal charges and the firing of all officers. His call to action for an investigation and accountability will comfort words to the unrest in the community. The police chief will also be held accountable as the citizens watch her response. In the care and custody of the police should mean safety and protection of all citizens they encounter. The blue light in the rearview mirror has to be checked and held accountable. I took the driver education in high school, and I got my permit and then my license to drive on my first examination trip. I got all the answers right and on the written exam, passed the road and sign test without failing on anything. I scored perfect on both tests, and I never had a problem driving. I love being behind the wheel, going where I please, parking where I should, letting others over in front of me and honking my horn at others when I see them out and about. Driving is wonderful. It is freedom. It is the ability to drive where you want without restriction of time or distance. Sometimes I used to get in my car and drive with no particular place or destination in mind. Just the freedom of driving was all I needed. I love being able to roll the windows down and take in God's breeze or roll them up and listen to the sweet, sweet music on my radio. It was all I needed to get by. In a rough time of stress and frustration, I remember my cool driver education teacher, Mr. Knight, telling me once I sat under the wheel for the first time to put the key in the ignition and to check my mirrors, especially the rear view mirror. What is coming up behind you can be more dangerous than what is in front of you. As the driver license agency, the state examiner officer watched me carefully. Once I sat in the vehicle and checked off his pad that I had checked the rear view mirrors first. Never would I know that this simple thing would need to be. Most of the time while driving, people get over without signaling left or right. Sometimes people speed up or drive too slowly. I've heard abusive car horns and seen fingers out the window showing signs of dire frustration. The thing that frightens me the most while driving is the blinking blue light. Since I have been a child, the blinking blue light in the rearview mirror meant trouble. No one wanted to be stopped day or night by it. It became a sign of distrust because of the way some of the drivers were treated. Very few people in my neighborhood told stories of an officer trying to help with a flat tire or a badly needed battery jump or waiting with a female motorist until a tow truck or a family member arrived. A stern warning and a careful bit of advice was the thinking of the past and only given by the good officers who patrolled our streets and highways in the day or the night. The pressure and stress of being on the right side of the law seems to be too much for officers who have mental issues and bigotry concerns. They have invaded the police forces as they invaded many communities of America. To serve and to protect is only a motto, not a rule to live and do your job by. The job is different now. They are looking for the big-time criminals. They are trying to bring in drug dealers who transport and distribute. They are looking for thieves who have stolen property and the ever-present drunk drivers. Then there are the citation violators and the speeders who refuse to slow down. It is a tough job. This is a job only suited for the best of the people, not the worst. Unions and well-paid lawyers protect the guilty officers who make the police look bad. That is why the people protest. Cannot the good in all of us come forward in these traffic stops? Why does it have to be a life or death situation at any time? Why did this mistrust of black motors have to begin? Can we find a solution for it to end? I get in my car now, and I put on my seatbelt, start the engine, adjust my side mirrors, and I look left and right. I look over my seat and out the back window. Then before I pull off, I look in the rear view mirror. The image that looks back at me has not changed. It is me in my black skin with fear and mistrust. I drive forward not wishing to see a blinking blue light behind me. I shed many tears for the ones who have died on the cold, wet concrete in their own warm blood. No more would they get the chance to share a drive by themselves or with their families to any appointments, vacation, events, affairs, or jobs they had. Just the simple pleasure of freedom behind the wheel has been taken forever. The bystanders and the people of goodwill will comfort the survivors of these tragedies in songs, words, praises, and new legislation to make our lives safer from the ones who are sworn to protect us. Yes, keep looking back through your rear view mirror. As you enjoy your next ride anywhere, drive freely and happily as it could be your last. And again, I would like to thank everyone for just a wonderful show. And I'm just about tired of going from week to week talking about how bad the policing situation is in America. This is a shame. And I pray that these police captains, these police unions, because it's on their side, these legislators, it's on their side to curb the violence against the African-American race and bring about a new history, a better policing in our communities. Talk to us. Don't make up things on your own and say this is the way to do things. Talk to us, the people in the community. I think that's the biggest problem. When you don't talk to someone that lives there, someone that knows the situation, that's the biggest problem. Because you have outsiders who bring in outsiding views and how you control something you know nothing about. So I think that is our biggest problem. But again, I thank every listener for listening today, and I thank you, Mr. Lee, for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you, Brother Alex, for your message to the community. We'd like to thank all our participants, our listening audience, our friends, our supporters. We would also ask for your help and your support. So please spread the word, share the word about MPH Radio. Comes on every bi-weekly. Next program will be on the 4th of February. Well, in the next 6 months, we ask you to use your listserv to share this program with your friends and supporters. We want to increase our listenership to 100,000 people in the next 6 to 8 months. And we can only do this by having your support. If you'd like to join the support committee of MPH Radio, please just email us at mphradio@yahoo.com, and we can tell you and show you how. So until next time, today's date, February 18, 2023, our theme, Black History Month, telling our story. We'd like to continue to use this form of communication as a means to be a strong community. Until next time, let's continue to fill in our missing pages, and remember, the MPH Radio is here for all of us. We'll see you on the 4th of February.
reason why, because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, vote for me and I'll set you free.
Rap on, brother, rap on.
Talking about love, man, brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, diminution, opposition to our nation. Control the sound of soul, shooting rockets to the moon, kids going up to soon. Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
Can't take.
back to support MPH Radio, you can do this by sending your contribution donation to NKL MPH Radio to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. Until next time, we see you on the 4th of March, 2023. This has been MPH Radio, the theme, Black History Month, telling our story. Yes, they have us living on the front line.
Don't want your bribery. Me ever talk about what I see. Me don't want to go America. Oh, me don't want to become bitter. Me don't want to take cocaine. Oh, to the broke of my brain. Oh, mama, mama, you got me living on the front line. Oh, mama, mama, you got me living on the front line. Whoa, I say yeah.
Stand up for your right. Get up.
sitting in the morning sun. I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change, everything still remains the same. What 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. It's 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time.
And if you had a choice of colors, Which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right?